Chapter 18. Traveling bandboxes must be as large as omnibuses. But see Mrs. Fantail in the morning, having taken in all sail. The chestnut curls have disappeared, and two limp bands of brown hair border her lean, sallow face. You see before you an ascetic, a nun, a woman worn by mortifications, of a sad yellow aspect, drinking salts at the well. A vision quite different from that rapturous one of the previous night's ballroom. No wonder Fantail does not come out of a morning. He had rather not see such a Rebecca at the well. Lady Kickleberry came for some mornings pretty regularly, and was very civil to Mr. Leader, and made Miss Fanny drink, when his lordship took a cup, and asked Lord Talboys and his tutor to dinner. But the tutor came, and, blushing, brought an excuse from Talboys, and poor Milliken had not a very pleasant evening after Mr. Baring Leader rose to go away. But though the water was not good, the sun was bright, the music cheery, the landscape fresh and pleasant, and it was always amusing to see the vast varieties of our human species that congregated at the springs and trudged up and down the green alleys. One of the gambling conspirators of the roulette table it was good to see here, in his private character, drinking down pints of salts like any other sinner, having a homely wife on his arm, and between them a poodle on which they lavished their tenderest affection. You see, these people care for other things besides trumps, and are not always thinking about black and red. As even ogres are represented, in their histories, as of cruel natures, and licentious appetites, and, to be sure, fond of eating men and women, but yet it appears that their wives often respected them, and they had a sincere liking for their own hideous children. And, besides the card players, there are band players. Every now and then a fiddle from the neighboring orchestra, or a disorganized bassoon, will step down and drink a glass of the water, and jump back into his rank again. Then come the burly troops of English, the honest lawyers, merchants, and gentlemen, with their wives and buxom daughters, and stout sons, that, almost grown to the height of manhood, are boys still, with rough wide-awake hats and shooting jackets, full of lark and laughter. A French boy of 16 has had a passion's ear that time, very likely, and is already particular in his dress, an ogler of the women, and preparing to kill. Adolphe says to Alphonse, avoyez le set charmin, Miss Fanny, la belle kick le bury, GT don ma parole, elle est fraiche comme une rose, la croise too rich, Alphonse. E me range, mon ami, voice too? La vie de garcon me peas. Ma parole d'honneur. G me range. And he gives Miss Fanny a killing bow, and a glance which seems to say, sweet Angles, I know that I have won your heart. Then besides the young French buck, whom we will willingly suppose harmless, you see specimens of the French raff, who goes oxo. Gambler, speculator, sentimentalist, duelist, traveling with Madame his wife, at whom other raffs nod and wink familiarly. This rogue is much more picturesque and civilized than the similar person in our own country, whose manners betray the stable, who never reads anything but Bell's Life, and who is much more at ease in conversing with a groom than with his employer. Here come Mr. Boucher and Mr. Fowler. Better to gamble for a score of nights with honest Monsieur Lenoir than to sit down in private once with those gentlemen. But we have said that their profession is going down, and the number of creeks daily diminishes. They are traveling with Mr. Blundell, who was a gentleman once, and still retains about him some faint odor of that time of bloom, and Blundell has put himself on young Lord Talboys, and is trying to get some money out of that young nobleman. But the English youth of the present day is a wide-awake youth, and male or female artifices are expended pretty much in vain on our young traveling companion. Who come yonder? Those two fellows whom we met at the table d'hôte at the Hôtel de Russie the other day. Gentlemen of splendid costume, and yet questionable appearances, the eldest of whom called for the list of wines, and cried out loud enough for all the company to hear, Laffite, 6 florins. Harry, shall we have some laugh-ite? You don't mind? No more do I then. I say, waiter, let's have a pint of ordinaire. Truth is stranger than fiction. You good fellow, wherever you are, why did you ask Harry to have that pint of ordinaire in the presence of your obedient servant? How could he do otherwise than chronicle the speech? And see, here is a lady who is doubly desirous to be put into print, who encourages it and invites it. It appears that on Langton's first arrival at Warborg with his traveling companion, a certain sensation was created in the little society by the rumor that an emissary of the famous Mr. Punch had arrived in the place. And, as we were smoking the cigar of peace on the lawn after dinner, looking on at the benevolent, pretty scene, Mrs. Hopkins, Miss Hopkins, and the excellent head of the family walked many times up and down before us, eyed us severely face to face, and then walking away, shot back fierce glances at us in the Parthian manner, and at length, at the third or fourth turn, and when we could not but overhear so fine a voice, Mrs. Hopkins looks at us steadily, and says, I'm sure he may put me in if he likes. I don't mind. Oh, ma'am. Oh, Mrs. Hopkins. How should a gentleman, who had never seen your face or heard of you before, want to put you in? What interest can the British public have in you? But as you wish it, and court publicity, here you are. Good luck go with you, madam. I have forgotten your real name, and should not know you again, if I saw you. But why could not you leave a man to take his coffee and smoke his pipe in quiet? We could never have time to make a catalogue of all the portraits that figure in this motley gallery. Among the travelers in Europe, who are daily multiplying in numbers and increasing in splendor, the United States dandies must not be omitted. They seem as rich as the miler of old days. They crowd in European capitals. They have elbowed out people of the old country from many hotels which we used to frequent. They adopt the French fashion of dressing rather than ours, and they grow handsomer beards than English beards. As some plants are found to flourish and shoot up prodigiously when introduced into a new soil, the ladies seem to be as well dressed as Parisians, and as handsome, though somewhat more delicate, perhaps, than the native English roses. They drive the finest carriages, they keep the grandest houses, they frequent the grandest company, and, in a word, the Broadway swell has now taken his station and asserted his dignity amongst the grandees of Europe. He is fond of asking Count Reinach to dinner, and Grafin Laura will condescend to look kindly upon a gentleman who has millions of dollars. Here comes a pair of New Yorkers. Behold their elegant curling beards, their velvet coats, their delicate primrose gloves and cambric handkerchiefs, and the aristocratic beauty of their boots. Why, if you had 16 quarterings, you could not have smaller feet than those, and if you were descended from a line of kings, you could not smoke better or bigger cigars. Lady Kicklebury deigns to think very well of these young men, since as he has seen them in the company of grandees, and heard how rich they are. Oh, is that very stylish-looking woman, to whom Mr. Washington Walker spoke just now, she asks of Kicklebury. Kicklebury gives a twinkle of his eye. H, that, mother. That is Madame la Princesse de Mogador, it's a French title. She danced last night, and danced exceedingly well, I remarked her. There's a very high-bred grace about the princess. Yes, exceedingly. We'd better come on, says Kicklebury, blushing rather as he returns the princess's nod. It is wonderful how large Kickleberry's acquaintance is. He has a word and a joke, in the best German he can muster, for everybody, for the high well-born lady, as for the German peasant maiden, or the pretty little washerwoman, who comes full sail down the streets, a basket on her head and one of Mrs. Fantail's wonderful gowns swelling on each arm. As we were going to the Schlossgarten, I caught a sight of the rogue's grinning face yesterday, close at little Gretel's ear under her basket. But spying out his mother advancing, he dashed down a bis street, and when we came up with her, Gretel was alone. one but seldom sees the English and the holiday visitors in the ancient parts of Nuremberg. They keep to the streets of new buildings and garden villas, which have sprung up under the magic influence of M. Lenoir, under the white towers and gables of the old Germantown. The Prince of Trent-Aquarant has quite overcome the old serene sovereign of Nuremberg, whom one cannot help fancying a prince like a prince in a Christmas pantomime, a burlesque prince with twopence halfpenny for a revenue, jolly and irascible, a prime minister kicking prince, fed upon fabulous plum puddings and enormous pasteboard joints, by cooks and valets with large heads which never alter their grin. Not that this portrait is from the life. Perhaps he has no life. Perhaps there is no prince in the great white tower that we see 4 miles before we enter the little town. Perhaps he has been mediatized and sold his kingdom to Monsieur Lenoir. Before the palace of Lenoir there is a grove of orange trees in tubs, which Lenoir bought from another German prince, who went straightway and lost the money which he had been paid for his wonderful orange trees over Lenoir's green tables at his roulette and Trent-Aquarant. A great prince is Lenoir in his way, a generous and magnanimous prince. You may come to his feast and pay nothing, unless you please. You may walk in his gardens, sit in his palace, and read his 1,000 newspapers. You may go and play at whist in his small drawing rooms, or dance and hear concerts in his grand saloon, and there is not a penny to pay. His fiddlers and trumpeters begin trumpeting and fiddling for you at the early dawn. They twang and blow for you in the afternoon. They pipe for you at night, that you may dance, and there is nothing to pay. Lenoir pays for all. Give him but the chances of the table, and he will do all this and more. It is better to live under Prince Lenoir than a fabulous old German Durklock whose cavalry ride wicker horses with petticoats, and whose prime minister has a great pasteboard head. Vive la Prince Lenoir! There is a grotesque old carved gate to the palace of the Durklock, from which you could expect none but a pantomime procession to pass. The place looks asleep. The courts are grass-grown and deserted. Is the sleeping beauty lying yonder, in the great white tower? What is the little army about? It seems a sham army. A sort of grotesque military. The only charge of infantry was this. One day when passing through the old town, looking for sketches. Perhaps they become croupiers at night. What can such a fabulous prince want with anything but a sham army? My favorite walk was in the ancient quarter of the town, the dear old fabulous quarter, away from the noisy actualities of life and Prince Lenoir's new palace out of eye and earshot of the dandies, and the ladies in their grand best clothes at the promenades, and the rattling whirl of the roulette wheel, and I like to wander in the glum old gardens under the palace wall, and imagine the sleeping beauty within there. Someone persuaded us one day to break the charm and see the interior of the palace. I am sorry we did. There was no sleeping beauty in any chamber that we saw, nor any fairies, good or malevolent. There was a shabby set of clean old rooms, which looked as if they had belonged to a prince hard put to it for money, and whose tin crown jewels would not fetch more than King Stephen's pantaloons. A fugitive prince, a brave prince struggling with the storms of fate, a prince in exile may be poor, but a prince looking out of his own palace windows with a dressing gown out at elbows, and done by his subject washerwoman, I say this is a painful object. When they get shabby they ought not to be seen. Don't you think so, Lady Kickleberry? Lady Kickleberry evidently had calculated the price of the carpets and hangings, and set them justly down at a low figure. These German princes, she said, are not to be put on a level with English noblemen. Indeed, we answer, there is nothing so perfect as England. Nothing so good as our aristocracy. Nothing so perfect as our institutions. Nothing. Nothing. Says Lady K, an English princess was once brought to reign here, and almost the whole of the little court was kept upon her dowry. The people still regard her name fondly, and they show, at the Schloss, the rooms which she inhabited. Her old books are still there, her old furniture brought from home, The presents and keepsakes sent by her family are as they were in the princess's lifetime. The very clock has the name of a Windsor maker on its face, and portraits of all her numerous race decorate the homely walls of the now empty chambers. There is the benighted old king, his beard hanging down to the star on his breast, and the first gentleman of Europe so lavish of his portrait everywhere, and so chary of showing his royal person all the stalwart brothers of the now all but extinct generation are there, their quarrels and their pleasures, their glories and disgraces, enemies, flatterers, detractors, admirers all now buried. Is it not curious to think that the King of Trumps now virtually reigns in this place, and has deposed the other dynasty? Very early one morning, wishing to have a sketch of the White Tower in which our English princess had been imprisoned, I repaired to the gardens, and set about a work, which, when completed, will no doubt have the honor of a place on the line at the exhibition. And, returning homewards to breakfast, musing upon the strange fortunes and inhabitants of the queer, fantastic, melancholy place, behold, I came suddenly upon a couple of persons, a male and a female, the latter of whom wore a blue hood or gli, and blushed very much on seeing me. The man began to laugh behind his mustaches, the which cachinnation was checked by an appealing look from the young lady, and he held out his hand and said, "How do you do, Titmarsh? Been out making some caicachas, hey?" I need not say that the youth before me was the heavy dragoon, and that the maiden was Miss Fanny Kickleberry. Or need I repeat that, in the course of my blighted being, I never loved a young gazelle to glad me with its dark blue eye, but when it came to, and see, the usual disappointment was sure to ensue. There is no necessity why I should allude to my feelings at this most manifest and outrageous case. I gave a withering glance of scorn at the pair, and, with a stately salutation, passed on. Miss Fanny came tripping after me. She held out her little hand with such a pretty look of deprecation, that I could not but take it, and she said, "Mr. Titmarsh, if you please, I want to speak to you, if you please," and, choking with emotion, I bade her speak on. "My brother knows all about it, and highly approves of Captain Hicks," she said, with her head hanging down, "and oh, he's very good and kind. And I know him much better now than I did when we were on board the steamer. I thought how I had mimicked him, and what an ass I had been. And you know," she continued, "that you have quite deserted me for the last 10 days for your great acquaintances. I have been to play chess with Lord Knightsbridge, who has the gout, and to drink tea constantly with that American lady, and you have written verses in her album, and in Lavinia's album, and as I saw that you had quite thrown me off, why I my brother approves of it highly, and Captain Hicks likes you very much, and says you amuse him very much indeed he does, says the arch little wretch." And then she added a postscript, as it were, to her letter, which contained, as usual, the point which she wished to urge. "You won't break it to Mama, will you be so kind? My brother will do that, and I promised her," and she ran away, kissing her hand to me. And I did not say a word to Lady Kickleberry, and not above 1,000 people at Noirborg knew that Miss Kickleberry and Captain Hicks were engaged. And now let those who are too confident of their virtue listen to the truthful and melancholy story which I have to relate, and humble themselves, and bear in mind that the most perfect among us are occasionally liable to fall. Kickleberry was not perfect, I do not defend his practice. He spent a great deal more time and money. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.